It's a strong title, isn't it? Sisters in the Dharma. And I came across it in a text by Nagarjuna, the Bodhisambhavakara, the first line of a verse in that text. Great compassion penetrates into the marrow of the bones. It is the support of all living beings. So I'm making the assumption that great compassion in that line, in this context, is Mahakaruna. Ordinary compassion that's been transformed through the fires of Shunyata. And that great compassion from the absolute bodhicitta needs to descend, penetrate, and even possess us, as Bhante says. The bodhicitta manifests, erupts, emerges as a profound spiritual experience. But here in this line, you get the very strong sense that it needs to descend right into the very marrow of our bones. So that's an interesting metaphor, isn't it? Our skeleton is a very important part of our body. Without it, we'd just be a blob on the carpet. But deeper than that, some bones have bone marrow. Now, I'm not a medic, but I understand that in some bones, there's undifferentiated cells or stem cells, bone marrow, that then become red cells, white cells, and platelets, which enter into our bloodstream or circulation, and are very, very important for the health and well-being of our bodies. So it gives a sense of great depth. If something penetrates into the marrow of your bones, it's really got into you. And if you look up marrow in the thesaurus, it says things like essence, gist, heart, kernel, pith, quick, quintessence, and even soul, spirit, and substance. But you get the sense that you're right into the quintessence, the depths of you, your bones, your experience. So this is how we want great compassion, Mahakaruna, to express itself right into our very depths as a radically transformative experience. So often we think of bodhicitta as, or any positive skill promotion as being in our heart centre. I'm not denying that. The heart centre is very, very important. That's the locus of metta, compassion, generosity, faith. It's the locus for our visualisation practice. And when I was thinking about this, I remembered that old lady in Strictly Ballroom. Strictly Ballroom, the movie? She's an old Spanish lady in Australia, of that sort of shape. And she's trying to teach a young buck, a young man, how to dance. I think it was the rumba. And she's got wonderful carriage. She's saying, from here, not just from here, it's from here, kind of down. So yes, the heart and the marrow somewhere, and the solar plexus, depth. So then, having come across that quote, which I'm excited by, I came across another quote, similar, from The Dual Ornament of Liberation, in the chapter on benevolence and compassion, which says, from the marrow of their bones, bodhisattvas view every sentient being as their own child. In this way, they constantly have the desire to benefit others. So again, that's the perspective of the bodhisattva. That great compassion is penetrated into the marrow of their bones, and from that perspective, they look out over sentient beings, out into samsara, and see all beings as like their only child. So I want us to hold that metaphor as an image of depth. Now, when I was thinking of doing this talk, I said, actually it was to Suchi Mani, I said, what should I talk about in the convention about bodhicitta? And she said, why bother? What is it and how to do it? Which I thought was a very pithy framework. So I'm going to say, what is it, why bother, and how to do it? I'm going to try anyway. So I just want to remind us what bodhicitta is. I'm sure we all know, as it were. Of course, what we refer to as absolute or ultimate bodhicitta, one can't describe or define. It can't be described or defined in words or concepts at all. It's beyond words and concepts. It's beyond time and space, so it's completely ineffable. However, it's often described as the union of the essence of voidness and the essence of compassion. So the essence of shunyata and the essence of Mahakaruna. So those things, perfectly conjoined or balanced. So the essence of voidness, the wisdom aspect of bodhicitta, is the realization that all phenomena are by nature empty of any inherent existence. Substance or essence, all phenomena are like a dream. And then from this perspective, the Bodhisattva sees that all beings, now perceived as without essence or inherent existence, without a sense of self, as it were, are ignorant of this truth themselves. They're ignorant of that perspective and consequently suffer. So this is similar, isn't it, to our refrain in the Bodhicitta practice. All beings desire happiness and wish to avoid suffering. All beings out of ignorance, in seeking happiness and seeking to avoid suffering, cause suffering to themselves and others. What a pity, what a tragedy. So the Bodhisattva sees that caravan of humanity staggering along the road of being, caught in the net of samsara, caught by the bounds of samsara, the fetters of samsara. So from the Bodhisattva's realization of voidness springs great compassion. And Bhante says that that great compassion arises like an unseen flower. So in his poem, The Unseen Flower, he says, compassion is more than emotion. It's something that springs up in the emptiness, which is you when you yourself are not there, so that you do not know anything about it. If they knew, it would not be compassion, but they can only smell the scent of the unseen flower that blossoms in the heart of the void. So Milarepa says, more succinctly, the supreme goal of the teaching is the emptiness whose essence is compassion. And I like a quote by somebody called Lex Hickson, who has translated some of the Perfection of Wisdom literature. It's a little bit more complicated, but I've always been very inspired by this paragraph in his introduction. He says, paradoxically, the more radically the teaching of perfect wisdom removes from our view the slightest physical or metaphysical basis, the slightest substantial self or world, the more intensely we fall in love with living beings, regarding them without exception as most precious, most beloved, most intimately connected to our existence. So bodhicitta, absolute bodhicitta, that union of the essence of voidness and the essence of compassion. But then absolute bodhicitta, ultimate bodhicitta, is expressed in the web of conditioned existence, in the stream of time, as relative bodhicitta, as compassion, as skillful means. But in the teachings, we're advised, if not warned, to hold relative and absolute in some kind of balance, in a practical sense. I think this is quite interesting. The text or the tradition says if we focus only on the voidness or impermanent aspect in our practice before we have the essence of voidness, as it were, and compassion arises spontaneously, if we focus in practice just on the voidness or the impermanent aspect, there's a tendency that we could become detached or even a little cynical. If we only focus on the relative, on ordinary compassion, as it were, well, the tendency is that we could become attached. So I think we often fall, you know, one way or the other, and I'm going to come back to creative tension in the talk later. But I was thinking, oh, sometimes the Bodhisattva ideal can seem so rarefied, so hard to relate to, that we can just think, can't we, oh, I'm just going to be kind. And I'm not knocking kindness, I'm not knocking compassion, generosity, sympathy. I mean, that's where we need to start. In all those positive emotions are the seed of bodhicitta. But I think if we say it in that kind of way, because we are overwhelmed by the perspective of the bodhisattva ideal, and without the perspective of voidness or impermanence, then this kindness will be limited, and that's not our intention. So it's important to hold the absolute and the relative in some kind of balance. So why bother? Well, I think you all know why you bother, but I guess we have a sense or an intuition or even an experience of what life would be like, can be like, sometimes is like when we get out of our own way. We can drop those selfish, self-regarding concerns even for a second and respond completely to others with love and compassion. We have those experiences individually, in meditation, collectively. And that's very, very positive. You know, we feel that expansion. It's a very happy, joyous experience. But we also, don't we know the pain when that experience fades and we fall back into selfish concerns and even jealousy, envy, resentment, blame, etc. So we experience that painful restriction. So at least we can imagine an experience, an ongoing experience, where that open-heartedness actually is unlimited and continues forever, as it were. And that's how we would like to be, I'm sure. And then there's so much suffering in the world. We just look out into the world. We just look at our friends or in our own experience, physical experience, emotional experience, our friends, bereavement, loss, illness, and then we look out into the world. There is so much suffering. It's overwhelming. And we long for a way to be able to face that experience, be able to be of help in that world of suffering. So those are a couple of reasons, I think, why we bother. So some years ago, I got up really early and I was going away from where I was living. So I turned on the news before I meditated, not something I do very often. And because I wanted to know what the weather was like and what to wear, you know how you do. And there was some terrible news on the news about some troubled part of the world, a part of the world that I had been to several times. So it kind of, it went in, as it were. And then I began to meditate and engage in the Green Tara practice. And I was reasonably concentrated. But as I continued with the practice, I had this question that became more and more conscious, I suppose. And it wasn't a new question, but it was a question arising in the context of that practice, which was, what's the point of sitting here, visualising these wonderful beings? Wouldn't it be better if I was out wherever it was, and trying to help? And it's not that I take my hat off to anyone who goes and helps in troubled spots, but it was in the context, you know, of a meditation practice. And it's a question I'd had over the years, and sometimes, I suppose, expressed this doubt. But here it was more just, it just kept coming, and I kept letting it be and letting it arise and reflecting on it. And then I had the experience in the meditation practice of Avalokiteshvara suddenly becoming incredibly vivid, particularly the Chintamani in his heart. And he said, really, this is the most important thing you can be doing. This is where you need to be. You need to really develop bodhicitta as your primary practice, as it were. So that had quite a strong effect on me. It's not that I know that I don't have to practice day by day and practice all those little acts of kindness and so on, but I suppose all that needs to be underpinned, as it were, at least a partial glimpse of the essence of voidness and compassion. So that's been I've remembered that experience and it stayed with me. And it reminds me a bit of a quote by Shantideva, the quote from the Guarding of Awareness, where he says, "Where would I find enough leather to cover the entire surface of the earth? But with leather soles beneath my feet, it's as if the whole world had been covered." So his whole text is about practice towards bodhicitta, but he's also saying, in a way it's a mind training. The primary training is training the mind of generosity, the mind of compassion, any circumstances that you meet. So that was, I think, why bother. So I'm going to move on to how. And if I've got time, I'm going to look at three ways of developing bodhicitta. But before I do that, I just want to say that we are looking at this in the context of making our effective going for refuge, real going for refuge. So perhaps it's worth just returning to the meaning of going for refuge. Because we just say those words, I'm going for refuge, I'm going for refuge, am I going for refuge, you're going for refuge. And Bhante said it, we should say, really, going for refuge to the three jewels. We shouldn't shorthand it. But he says, doesn't he, when he's describing the centrality of going for refuge, that it's a single, central, crucial, unique, existential, spiritual experience which unfolds in different aspects, dimensions, or facets, and you can deepen through different levels. So it's quite a profound experience, and it has these different facets. Unfortunately, the facet of bodhicitta is called the altruistic dimension of my going for refuge, which is terribly unpoetic when you think about the glories of the Mahayana. But anyway, it's the other regarding aspect of that crucial, central, existential experience. And it expresses that spiritual life and the spiritual path is by nature is by its very nature altruistic. It has another regarding aspect, a growth in harmony, friendship, love and compassion. So we're trying to make our effective level of bodhicitta, the altruistic dimension of our going for refuge, real. So on an effective level, it means that we have a wholehearted commitment to act in accordance with the bodhisattva ideal and all that that implies, and a genuine, sincere effort to practice the paramitas. And then we're trying to, through all our practices, bring about that glimpse of the essence of voidness and the essence of compassion. Now, Bhante, it's quite important that he says, in the levels of going for refuge, you have ethnic, provisional, I'm not going to go into all this, ethnic, provisional, effective and real, that the altruistic dimension of going for refuge only applies to those first three. When you get to real bodhicitta, you've transcended altruistic dimensions and self-dimensions. You've transcended self and other. So you're in a completely other experience, as it were. He says something else has begun to take over. So he describes that in, I think it's looking ahead a little way, he describes that experience of the arising of real bodhicitta as a non-egoistic stream of spiritual energy, even consciousness, that manifests in a number of people simultaneously. And if that did happen, there would be no conflict. We would function in perfect harmony. We would be a true Sangha, an Arya Sangha. We would literally be the hands and arms of Avalokiteshvara. And I remember being at that talk and thinking, did he say that? He didn't say mythic, symbolic. He said literally. I think we probably many of us went to check that out. So it's interesting to reflect that, you know, if we are practicing intensely together and that experience arises, we are literally, we are an Arya Sangha. We are literally the hands and arms of Avalokiteshvara. And as Suchimani said in a previous seminar, he said, didn't he, the bodhicitta was more likely to arise in a number of people working intensively together in a collective. And then he says, or in the practice of Sevenfold Puja, engaged in wholeheartedly. I'm going to come back to intensive collective practice later on. So, different ways of developing bodhicitta, or making our effective going for refuge into real going for refuge, our effective bodhicitta into real bodhicitta. Now, in a way, there's many, 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 many practices and methods which can do that. In a way, any practice with intensity and wholeheartedness, and I think with the motivation to transcend the self-other dichotomy, as it were, can give rise to bodhicitta. So the first one I've chosen a few, and the first one I'm going to focus on is the practice of gratitude. So Bhante's spoken about gratitude many, many times, and actually he included it in his most recent talk on the combined convention. And he said it's one of the greatest and most important Buddhist virtues. And he said he had much to be grateful for. So I remember that many years ago I studied in seminar with Bhante the dual ornament of liberation and a chapter on benevolence and compassion. And this again is a line from a text that I've never forgotten. The line says, the development of metta, or I think in the text it says benevolence, but the development of metta, loving kindness, depends on the memory of benefits received. So the development of metta, and I think by implication compassion, because that follows in the same chapter, depends on the memory of benefits received. So in the text, the way that's unfolded is there's a graphic description of all the things your mum did for you, the sacrifices she made, the hardships she underwent, all the things she did when you were a tiny baby, all the kindness she showed you. So there's a long reflection on that, a great graphic detail, a Tibetan mum doing that with her Tibetan baby in that period of time, 14th century Tibet. The implication being that if you really reflected on that, how you did nothing for yourself, someone did everything for you, you know, wiped your bottom and wiped your nose and burped you. And, you know, when we had babies here on the convention, you can see, can't you, that kind of full-time, 24/7 care. So reflecting on that, because the relationship with one's mother is so strong, and I'm assuming here we have a positive relationship with our mother, first of all, you know, such a strong, visceral, primary relationship, that reflecting on the great kindness and hardship and sacrifice she underwent for you, strong gratitude arises. And that gratitude is so strong, you really want to repay the kindness. So then you reflect, and this may be a little bit more difficult for us, but you reflect, at least in imagination, in the great cycle of rebirth, every being at some point or other has been your mother. So they have shown you that same kindness. So you reflect on, and the idea of the practice is to generate the same feeling of gratitude, the same intense desire to repay that kindness. And you think, well, what's the best way to repay the kindness of all sentient beings who have been my mother in a previous life? And of course, the best way is to develop bodhicitta, because then you're a resource for them and you're going to help them understand the nature of existence and be free from suffering. So it's only a couple of pages, but it goes from bottom wiping to bodhicitta in a couple of paragraphs. I always found that, you know, it's quite good, isn't it? And it just goes back to that quote, doesn't it, from the marrow of their bones, the bodhisattva views all sentient beings as their only child. And then the bodhisattva is the mother, as it were. All sentient beings are the children. That's not necessarily an easy practice for us, because in the West, you know, we can have quite complicated psychological relationships with our parents and with our mother. And Banti said this when we were studying it. However, a friend of mine took up this practice who had a very difficult relationship with her mother. And she did it just for a little bit every day before she meditated. And she did, you know, turn around a difficult relationship. She did heal that relationship. So you could use it in that way as a healing practice. I know with my own mother, it's not that I did that in that sort of conscious way, but I had a very difficult relationship with my mother back in the day. And I'd been on this seminar, and I'd been to visit my mother, not that close together, but I'd been to see her. And a very close family friend had died and had a very strong effect on her. And then I went on solitary. And somewhere all that came together in me becoming an adult, really. Really seeing my mother as an individual in her own right. You know, that turning around from thinking what she didn't do, what she didn't give me, how she got it all wrong, into thinking, oh, you know, she's a person with her own set of circumstances, her own set of conditions, her own troubles that I know nothing about, her own sorrows. And, you know, that kind of giving rise to a kind of great release of love for her and a letting go of a lot of resentment. So in a way, it wasn't such a focused practice, but I think it came out of that study. And it not only had an effect on my relationship with her, which it did, but on my ability to feel better and on my relationships with other people. Because I think if there's something not right in such a basic relationship, it has a big effect on us. So you can use it as a healing reflection. But Bante's point was that, well, if it's difficult, it's supposed to be straightforward as a practice. So if it's difficult in any way, maybe don't do it. But he said, yes, but we can still reflect on benefits received. We've been given so much. We come into the world with nothing. And although the world's not perfect, the world most of us have come into, there's language, there's culture, there's all kinds of things. You can just sit and kind of think about all the things that when you first arrived, you had not contributed towards. So this purpose is to naturally develop gratitude and then naturally want to give something back and then think, what can I give back that's most precious? And I suppose for us it can be teaching the Dharma, can't it? Maybe it doesn't have to be, you know, the ultimate bodhicitta at that point, but, you know, I can give the Dharma to people. I can help people in any way I can, but I can also help, support and give the Dharma. It's a very important quality. In a way it sounds quite simple, doesn't it, gratitude? But it can have huge implications for our practice. So these days I tend to practice that in terms of the four mind turnings. I tend to reflect on the four mind turnings most days before I engage in another practice. So particularly those four mind trainings of the precious human birth, death and impermanence, actions and consequences, and the nature of conditioned existence. And I tend to focus perhaps more on the first two. I think it's good to reflect on death every day. But the precious human birth,
there are reflections there about your endowments and your freedoms. And so I think we could all find 5 minutes in a day and in our own organic way reflect on benefits received and see what effect that has. I find it very heart-opening, and whatever kind of state I'm in, and I'm never that good first thing in the morning, it kind of helps, it loosens me up and opens me up towards the following practice. So that's one way we can develop or make our effective bodhicitta real bodhicitta. Easy to do in daily life, a little bit every day. So the second practice I've highlighted is Vasubandhu's four factors. Now, Bhante, in the Bodhisattva Ideal, when he talks about practices to develop bodhicitta, he talks about practices of the Sevenfold Puja and practice of reflection on Vasubandhu's four factors. So I'm not going to say anything about Sevenfold Puja. I think we do puja, we know about puja. But I think the interesting thing about the puja is it's, I suppose it's a gradual accumulative practice. Each verse kind of opens up out more and more, doesn't it? Whereas Vasubandhu's four factors, particularly the second two factors, in a way they focus on creating creative tension to such a pitch where there is a breakthrough. So this is what I'm going to talk about, creative tension. So just to remind you what those four factors are, the first one is recollection of the Buddha. So that brings about energy and faith. The second one is seeing the faults of conditioned existence. The third one is observing the sufferings of living beings. And the fourth one is contemplating the virtues of the Tathagata. So I'm just going to look at two and three. So seeing the faults of conditioned existence, I think Punyamala did this one yesterday. Looking at conditioned existence and seeing that conditioned existence is impermanent, insubstantial, and if we don't understand that, that leads to dukkha. So this is the kind of wisdom aspect, isn't it? We see through conditioned existence, we see through the mundane, and if we do see that things are insubstantial and impermanent, then the follow-on from that is we'll be less enmeshed in those activities or those things, whatever they may be. So there's a sense of positive withdrawal, and a positive side, I think that's a sense of freedom, of energy freeing up. So it's the wisdom aspect, it's a going forth, as it were, from being completely enmeshed in the mundane. Sometimes it's referred to as withdrawal. So we're kind of feeling free and we're moving away from things, and it's a bit more of an individual experience. Oh, I'm freed up, I'm freer. And then we're asked, and moving away from conditioned existence, and then we're asked, as it were, to turn back to samsara, as it were, and contemplate the sufferings of living beings. So in the texts, this can be described in very extensive ways. It's every suffering of every realm gone into in great detail. So, you know, trying to engender in you empathy, solidarity, love, compassion. So you turn back, there's that sense of involvement. I think that's expressed in that quote by Lex Hickson. The freer you are, paradoxically, the more you fall in love with sentient beings. Although sometimes it isn't that easy. So in a way, they're opposites. You're moving away, you're moving towards, and or moving back towards. And I think it can be expressed in that myth of Avalokiteshvara. Avalokiteshvara, in his form as the hero of the cries of the world, there's that story, isn't there, where Avalokiteshvara is liberated. He's free, and he's going to Nirvana, as it were. So he's off, isn't he? He's nearly at the pearly gates of Nirvana. He's nearly there. But there's something sort of slightly distracting him behind him. A very, very, very faint sound that he eventually kind of turns back and to know what it is. And it is the sound of the cries of beings still enmeshed in samsara, their pain, their suffering. So in the story, in the myth, in the metaphor, he turns back. Well, he's not any less liberated, but he turns back to help all sentient beings in samsara. Now, Bhante's written quite a lot about creative tension, and I think these four factors, and maybe creative tension, not something we necessarily consciously reflect on that much, so I just wanted to sort of highlight it, because I think it's interesting, because I don't know about you, but I like comfort, personally. And we often think attention is bad for us. And certain kinds of tension, of course, are bad for us. But there is such a thing as creative tension. It's spiritual experience. So he says in the survey, it's a little bit more intellectual the way he says it here, but he says, it's like a spark that leaps up when two electrically charged terminals are brought into contact. So the bodhicitta arises not from theoretical considerations, but from the conjunction in the spiritual life of the devotee of two quite different, seemingly divergent trends of thought and feeling. So the art of producing the thought of enlightenment consists in stimulating these two trends so that there's mounting tension between them that ultimately causes them to coalesce at a higher level. So elsewhere, he's talking a little bit more kind of practically. He says, and this is interesting, whenever there is a breakthrough from one level of spiritual experience to another, it's generally the result of a painful dilemma. So that's interesting to think about. Some problem that can't be solved intellectually on its own level. So it's a bit like the Zen koan. He says you don't need to go looking for a Zen koan. You don't need to think about the one hand clapping. Well, you can if you want. It's a paradoxical, self-contradictory situation which just arises in your own experience. These koans spring up naturally in our own life and practice from our own effort to develop. And I suspect if we're practicing intensively, the more we'll find ourselves in those situations. So we find ourselves in an existential dilemma where we have two choices, two things. They're both valid. How do we choose? What do we do? It's an uncomfortable spot to be in. We're in a real dilemma. We can't escape. We have to act. We have to choose. But he also says our unconscious strategy is usually to try and suppress one side in order to feel comfortable. I mean, it's uncomfortable, isn't it? So we don't want that. But he says eventually you're going to need to take both sides into consideration, and there will be some kind of breakthrough. So he says we need to recognise them and learn how to work with them, not moving to one pole or the other for the sake of comfort. So there's all kinds of dilemmas like that, aren't there? Life and death, self and other, absolute and relative, wisdom and compassion, the big ones. But in our own life and practice, they'll manifest in whatever way they manifest. So the trick, isn't it, is to spot them and stay in that uncomfortable existential dilemma. Stay with it, as it were. So I was thinking about those kind of things in my own life, and I mean, the one that came to mind immediately, I mean, it's some years ago now, was when, like 10 years ago, I was asked to become a public preceptor, which was a big responsibility spiritually and practically. At the same time, my mum got very sick. So, two important situations I really wanted to give as much as I could to, and how to do that. And sometimes it did mean I needed to be in two places at the same time, which was, of course, impossible. But on other levels, it just was, And I had fantastic support. I mean, I didn't do it alone. I embraced those two situations alone. I didn't think of it in so much in terms of, mounting the tension. I didn't really need to do that. The tension was very strong. I thought of it really as trying to go deeper. I just felt I had to kind of go deeper and deeper to find some place in my experience and practice that could somehow, at least some of the time, hold those two, very strong desires and commitments in me somehow. So yeah, not easy, and there are times when I would be in despair, or I'd just be wrecked or whatever. But I think having to do that over, I think it was about 3 years, wasn't it, with all that support, which was I think the Sangha at its very best, friendships at their very best, I think I grew through trying to do that. At least I hope so. Yeah, so sometimes they're not as big as that. Sometimes they're kind of smaller situations. And the way they happen kind of every day in some way or other, don't they? Do I want to be on my own, or do I want to go and connect with people? It's one of my kind of
often dilemmas.
I'm lonely. Oh, I'll go and see people. Oh, I'm overwhelmed. I'll go back to my room. I'm lonely. So a parody experience of being an introvert who manifests as an extrovert, which is also one of those things. So sometimes they're just there, aren't they? Kind of, you know, when you think, silly, but anyway, those kind of experiences. So they can range in all kinds of different ways. I think the art is, isn't it, to realise when there's tension in that kind of way that could be spiritually beneficial. Can you stay with the tension? Can you use it as a koan in that way? Can you even ratchet up the tension? See what happens. So I think we're such a comfort living society that might be a good practice for us. Now, Bhante's not only written about it, I think it's part of the way he teaches us. I think Sangharakshita is an agent provocateur for the bodhicitta. I've been in lots of teaching situations with Bhante. Sometimes people who don't know Bhante, sometimes people say this, they'd like to have more contact with him, or they'd like to be in seminars and things with him, but it wasn't always easy. So I think he's a great stirrer. He likes to stir, he likes to provoke, he likes to create the tension, he likes to up the ante. I think that's a way in which he teaches. So I've just got a couple of examples. You know, he's got this thing, hasn't he, about more and more of less and less. Now, we can interpret that, and I think this is true, as depth. But my experience sometimes of going to Bhante and saying, oh, I'm doing this project and X, Y, and Z about it, you know, I'm finding it difficult. And he'll say, yes, well, you need to, you know, be more wholehearted in the project, and you need to go on solitary, and you need to meditate more, and you need to spend time alone, and you need to see more of your friends. So that's one way I think he sort of ups the ante. Nods of agreement. Another experience I have is of being on seminars with him years ago, and some of those seminars were mixed, but many of them were single sex. And my experience on some of them was that Bhante would go on and on and on about how great the men were. They asked better questions. I can't remember. They did this, they did that, they did the next thing. Until you wanted to scream. And then I discovered from a Dharmachari friend of mine, it just wasn't a one-way traffic. Good. He did the same thing to the men, and this Dharmachari said to me, I thought, if Bhante says one more time, you know, how well looked after he is by the women when he's on a women's seminar, how well they do this, how well they do that, you know, he was going to scream. So, He's a stirrer. Latest letter. It's provoking us to think. Think things through, provoking us to think. And sometimes, you know, things go one way, don't they? And he'll be over here, and then you all go over there. Oh. He'll be over there. I've seen him do that in a discussion, actually. kind of get a discussion going. I mean, it was a topic we needed to talk about, and I can't remember the content, but it was, I suppose everybody was, you know, getting inspired and going with it. And as we were going with it, I think we were getting a bit more rigid and a bit more literal and a bit more something, you know, but we were all kind of going. And then he just sort of went very feminine and his body, and he just relaxed and said, oh, well, but, you know, blah, 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 blah. And it's like you've been taken, you know, sorry, you beat the microphone, taken to the edge of a precipice. So again, it's a very small example, but I think, he's a stirrer, he provokes. It's a way of teaching. And, you know, we need to notice our responses and reactions when we're in that sort of situation. Not comfortable. Not comfortable. He's a great tease. That's not always comfortable. I have been teased. I'm going to say mercilessly, but maybe that's the wrong word. But I have been on a seminar with him where there was something about me and my behaviour that he just kept teasing and, you know, prodding and poking and... You can also be incredibly kind, of course. I don't want to just think I only have those experiences, Bhante, but I'm trying to highlight creative tension. I think the other way that he in a way, encourages us to be in these kind of existential situations is through intense practice, both individually and collectively. So he said the bodhicitta is more likely to arise in a situation where people are working intensively together in some way or other. So I think out of intense engagement, in whatever way, you come up against yourself, you come up against other people, you find yourself in those kind of situations of tension, don't you? And you have to, if you're going to carry on living with those people, working with those people, being on a team with those people, whatever it is, something has to give at some point. So it isn't all about, you know, harmony, is it? Harmony is a hard one, to intensive effort, practice, engagement. I think that's why he encourages that. I think it's a locus, the arising of the bodhicitta, but it sometimes, it just brings us up against ourselves and each other. And I suppose, the movement was very focused around community centres and team-based right livelihoods for many, many years. Now it's not that they're not there, but demographically there's a shift and there's proportionately less people engaged in those activities. So I suppose we just need to find ways, don't we, to intensively engage with each other. We can come together on retreats, on conventions, order weekends, and so on. We can be in teams, you can find ways of working together, work at centres. We can live together and still work together, but I think we just need to find maybe different forms to bring about that intensive engagement as a means to develop bodhicitta. So don't shy away from creative tension. Sit in the uncomfortable spot and see if you can up the ante. Okay, I've got one more means of developing bodhicitta. Remembering that there are many. So I've been inspired by the Bodhisattva ideal, it seems like, since I first came along, partly because Bhante's always taught and exemplified that. I've been very into collective practice, very inspired by my practice of my Yidam practice. Love the Mahayana sutras that Bhante unfolded. I love all the sort of magic and the mystery and the colour. I love all that. When I first came along, though, it's interesting. I would want to save all sentient beings. I was very young. I want to save all sentient beings, and then I think, well, I don't know how to. So I get depressed and go back to bed. So we can be overwhelmed, can't we, by our youthful idealism. So I think I needed to learn ways of working with those tendencies, but more realistic ways of working. So I took up the Green Tara practice. I was drawn to Green Tara, but I think it was specifically because I was overwhelmed by suffering, really, and I didn't understand for a while that actually what I was experiencing was horrified anxiety or pity, and it wasn't really anything to do with compassion. So the Green Tara practice, I think that fearlessness and that ability to just respond from that meditative aspect, from shunyata to all sentient beings, just trying to embody that over the years has been a practice. But more recently, I've been inspired by the mind training teachings in the last several years. So these are the teachings particularly expressed in the 8 verses and the 7-point mind training. Now, you may or may not be familiar with these teachings. In a way, they come out of Mahayana, the mainstream Mahayana. They're often, you can see the connection back with the Bodhicharyavatara of Shantideva. I think what they do is take the central teaching in the mind trainings is taking hardship onto the path. That's how it's described. Taking difficulties onto the path. So Atisha, who's one of the mind training, great mind training teachers, says of this third section of the mind training, "By the gracious Lama's blessings, may I see whatever adverse conditions, events, and sufferings before me as tricks of the evil spirit of ego clinging, and use them as the path of bodhicitta." So it's a way of overcoming pride, giving up blame, seeing one's enemy as one's friend or as a precious resource, seeing any difficulty whatsoever, be it a person or a difficulty, emotional, psychological, physical, not as an obstacle to practice, but a way of deepening one's practice. It's also a way of seeing, I think, what our priorities really are. So if our main priority is to have a comfortable life, so it has to be, you know, like 99% of our priorities to have a comfortable life. Some comfort's fine. If it's our main priority in life, then any kind of adversity or difficulty will be seen as bad, won't it? Seen as an obstacle. But if our main priority is for spiritual awakening, then we will learn to see adversity as an important element on the path, helping us to develop, and particularly develop kshanti or patience, which again, which is such an important spiritual quality for the bodhisattva. So I particularly like the verses in the 8 verses, particularly the middle 3, because it's giving us very practical guidelines as to how to deal with difficult people, and often our difficulties are with others. So, I will learn to cherish beings of bad nature and those oppressed by strong sins and suffering as if I had found a precious treasure very difficult to find. So this is just someone you bump into, someone who's having a bad day, someone who's exuding, you know, unskillful mental states. It's not particularly personal. They're oppressed by strong sins and suffering. So rather than react, you think, oh, I found a precious treasure very difficult to find. It's very hard practice. It's very difficult, very challenging. And then it goes on, when others out of jealousy treat me badly, with abuse, slander, and so on, I will learn to take on all loss and offer victory to them. So then it's a bit more personal. It's personal. And the last verse in this section is, when one whom I have benefited with great hope unreasonably hurts me very badly, I will learn to view that person as an excellent spiritual guide. So that's just to give you an idea of what we've been asked to do. So I think it's very interesting because it's asking us, there's another phrase from the mind training which says, drive all blames into one. So you drive all blames into one, which is that ego clinging. So it's basic Dharma really, but it's kind of very potently put, I think. It's saying that whatever happens to us, and it's not denying that you feel hurt or there may be harm done or injustice experienced, how you react within yourself, how you react to others is your responsibility. And you would only react, I suppose, with patience and compassion if you didn't have that sense of ego, that fixed sense of ego. If you were in touch with that open-hearted love, compassion, and in touch with the essence of voidness, you would respond with compassion. So you're trying to turn something around, aren't you, that's very, very deeply ingrained, as a way of getting rid of that ego clinging, that self-centeredness, and also, you know, our kind of habitual ways of responding when we're hurt in some way or other, when our pride is hurt. However subtle, there's often a kind of desire to, as it were, redress the balance, to kind of, our ego wants to feel good again. And, you know, it can be a very subtle thought about, well, blame, but even sometimes some kind of retaliation, even just within your mind. You may not be like this, but I recognise those tendencies in myself. So it seems to me a very nitty-gritty teaching. To me, it is a way of trying to get compassion, kshanti, great compassion, down into the marrow of the bones. So, you know, the Bodhisattva vows, the Bodhisattva precepts, you know, not to give in to hatred, not to give in to retaliation in any way whatsoever. So this is what you're trying to practice, and you're trying to bring that into being in your relationship with other people who you would normally react to. The practical way of doing it in the 8 verses is you practice tonglen, you practice the meditation way, you practice the taking and the sending. So one of the commentators on the mind training says, you must learn to lean into difficulties. So I really like that, you know, you just lean into difficulties. Because mostly when there's something difficult, we lean out, don't we? So it's just slightly changing one's posture, I suppose, isn't it? Small steps. And another commentator says, to do the mind training, you don't need great learning, but you do need great courage. So ideally, in this approach to practice, nothing is an obstacle. No difficulty is an obstacle. It's all kind of grist for the mill. It's all material to help you work on changing your mind, heart, turning it around, developing particularly kshanti and compassion. So it's very difficult, but even to just remember it, I think, in a difficult situation with someone, even to just remember all the 8 verses, something about, you know, precious friend. just a, you know, memory of it. And they're easy verses to memorize, actually. It can kind of give you that gap before you mentally react or physically react. So I've used this over the past few years, and I can't remember when I first got really interested in it, but again, at the time that my mother was ill, my brother returned back from... I hadn't seen him for years, and I found myself living under the same roof with him for periods of time in the house, tiny house we grew up in when we were children. And he's an older brother, so I have no experience of life without that dynamic and without my samskaras in relationship to him. And it's always been, for me, a difficult relationship. So suddenly I'm in this very sort of difficult, for me, very difficult, painful experience, the things that went on, as it were. And I just felt, I suppose I felt the pain of that difficult communication. I felt humiliated. I had years of practice, and, you know, aspire to the bodhicitta, and I don't like my brother. I fall back into patterns that I had when I was 3. So I tried really hard, you know, I tried all kinds of things. I put Edgar in the metta bhavana. Poor thing, he probably never knew anything about this. He'd be in the metta bhavana, in the bodhicitta practice, in the refugee practice. He did a lot of spiritual practice. But also, you know, these kind of reflections. You know, I just use it. But sometimes I just would think I'm not getting anywhere. I sort of despair that I could sort of turn around that kind of such deep conditioning in samskaras. But, you know, over time, so I think time passed, and I think, you know, you wake up one day and you think, oh, you know, I feel, yeah, I feel something's changed, you know, I feel freer of that constriction. So, very difficult work, but good work to do. And more recently, had some very, very difficult neighbours, very close, flats, very, very close, very, very noisy, all hours of the day and night. Very messy, probably criminal, and also they did perpetrate a not severe but a criminal act on Tara Kantra and I. So we realised after a bit of undergoing this for, I think it was nearly a year actually, at some point we realised in conversation, the two of us, Tara Kantra and I, that we'd kind of gone, you know. And I think before that we tried to communicate with them and negotiate and things. And we just, after the criminal act, is it where we go? And we just start to live constricted, and they just go about doing whatever they're doing quite happily and merrily. And you're obsessed with them and what they do and what they might do. And are they going to play music really loud at 3 o'clock this morning? Or am I going to get any sleep? So that kind of, you know, withdrawal and constriction. And we just decided to change, you know, well, we need to, yes, we've got into that state and we need to stop talking about them. We need to put them in our metta, and we just need to kind of, yeah, open up towards them. So it is a bit similar, I think, as trying to see them as people again and see them as an opportunity to practice. And, yeah, I was in the process of thinking, how can I get back into communication with them, which might have been at some risk, I wasn't sure. So I was kind of writing a letter just to kind of get, you know, my negotiatory, communicatory, metaphor thoughts kind of in some sort of shape. And then they got evicted. So, which was very strange. Nothing to do with me. But something changed in the situation, and they left. But yeah, in that process of trying to turn an incredibly difficult situation around, that's what the mind training points to, I think. Whatever it is, however difficult, you know, you have the, if you have courage, you have the possibility to turn it around in the way we must turn it around in order to transform hatred, resentment, retaliation, and maybe particularly blame. We so easily fall into blame, don't we? Particularly in our modern culture, we live in a blame culture. And it's the ego clinging which is to blame, which is hard to take on, isn't it? So it needs quite a lot of reflection, but I personally have found it very helpful, and it's a kind of, it's a down here kind of practice, backed by all the other wonderful, magical things about the bodhicitta. So just some ways that I, reflecting on for developing bodhicitta, and many, many other practices and ways, but gratitude, creative tension, and taking difficulties onto the path. So I wanted to conclude just by asking the question, well, how do we know whether we've changed our effective bodhicitta into real bodhicitta? And I want to support and back what Punyamala said yesterday about a gradual process. So then it's a quote by Bhante somewhere. So he says, you might have read a Mahayana sutra and have strong feeling of compassion and devotion, which is genuine and sincere, but it is limited and can eventually fade. So how can one be sure that one's made one's effective bodhicitta real? Even if you feel sure, it's only demonstrated by persistence in it. You may be suspicious after a long time that it is not fading. It is not becoming less. In fact, it is increasing, growing and developing. But you need a long time to see whether or not it is just the effect of willed effort that will probably lead to a reaction rather than truly spontaneous.